happened pretty close to the same time that the derailment happened. And as far as the crew members, there was a conductor, an engineer, and a trainee. But most all the Class I railroads in America currently have a minimum of two people on the crew. And they just happened to have an extra one because they had a trainee. Now, the railroads want to go to single-person crews and then no-people crews. That's their goal. And they fight tooth and nail in Washington, D.C. to not have any additional regulations and to roll back the regulations that they do have.
I mean, this is astounding. These trains go on for miles. And aren't they supposed to spend a certain amount of time inspecting each car that has toxic chemicals?
Well, yes, absolutely. There's supposed to be Class I brake air tests on all the cars. And the railroads have rolled back regulations on doing inspections and air brake tests as well. They've laid off 30% of their workforce in the last 5 years. It's all about adhering to the wishes and whims of Wall Street and lowering their operation ratio. The other thing that people aren't talking about as well are the employees that they do have. NS recently cut their training program in half, so they only get half the training that they used to get. I mean, they're rolling the dice, all the Class I railroads. And the thing that I would like to highlight is that nothing has changed with the freight railroads in America since this accident happened. They're not taking any action to change anything. The only way they're going to change anything is if they're forced to.
In fact, a derailment took place outside of Detroit with the same company. Let me bring in Topher Sanders to this conversation. Topher is a reporter at ProPublica covering railroad safety. You just wrote this piece, "A Norfolk Southern Policy Lets Officials Order Crews to Ignore Safety Alerts." Explain what you found. Give us background on all of this and also the overall picture of the major railroad conglomerates in the United States. There are like seven of them, right?
Yes, Amy. So a team of us reporters at ProPublica started looking into, you know, various aspects of the derailment and the policies and the kind of internal operation rules of Norfolk Southern became very interesting to us. And we were able to learn about this one particular policy where some years ago they created something called the Wayside Detector Help Desk. And it's basically a team of personnel that review data coming from these hot boxes that you mentioned earlier. And that team, they're not dispatchers. They kind of understand data and they understand some of the workings and the workings of the train. They can make determinations that when crews receive certain alerts from these hot boxes, that crew, if they deem it necessary based on information that they have that's really opaque and unclear based on the policy, they can tell that crew to mush on. They can tell that crew to ignore that alarm that's coming from the hot box or coming from the dragging equipment detector or whatever kind of detector it is, and say, continue on because we have information that it otherwise tells us it's safe for you to do so.
So let me ask about what has been found and the number of derailments that there are. Over the past 20 years, overheated bearings have led to 416 derailments, according to the Federal Railroad Administration data on train accidents. Most have not been nearly as catastrophic as what happened in East Palestine. Is the Federal Railroad Administration able to regulate hot box detectors? Does it require railroads to report data on how they perform? And how has the regulation of trains its direct relation to lobbying in Washington?
There is no requirement for the Class I's reporting data related to hot boxes. All that information, as mentioned earlier by one of your other guests, is kind of held tightly within each organization. There's no rules or regulations about having the hot boxes or what those thresholds should be. One of the key things that came out of the preliminary report that I think everyone should pay attention to and be very keenly attuned to is the idea that the thresholds that should trigger alarm and concern for a crew on any given Class I railroad are wildly different. So on one railroad, that temperature threshold could be X. At another railroad, that temperature threshold could be 20, 30, 40 degrees different. And in this case, they were obviously trending hot. They went from about 60 or so degrees above ambient temperature on that wheel bearing to 100 degrees above ambient on that particular bearing between two detectors before they got to East Palestine. But that 60 degree change, that 40 degree change, that wasn't enough for the Norfolk Southern to determine that that needed to be dealt with at that moment, despite what we all saw on that security camera, that there was a fiery glow under the train 20 miles before the derailment. And so the chair of the NTSB forthrightly said that, yes, considering what these thresholds should be and whether or not there needs to be some uniformity around these thresholds on these temperature gauges is definitely something they'll be looking into.
Now, Topher, ProPublica has also learned that Norfolk Southern disregarded a similar mechanical problem on another train months earlier that jumped the tracks in Ohio, a train that was headed to Cleveland. What happened? What happened in the city of Sandusky, where thousands of gallons of some kind of molten paraffin wax was dumped?
Yes, that's candle wax, by the way. And it was molten at the time, so it would have been quite dangerous, catastrophic, had that actually made contact with anyone when it derailed. So what happened there was the wayside desk, as it was explained to us, actually receiving data about the same kind of issue. They saw something trending hot on the train, a wheel trending hot, a bearing trending hot. They did instruct that train to stop, but they brought out a mechanic to review the issue and see what was going on. And surprisingly, they were able to look at this train, something that had a trending hot mechanism, and they told this crew to mush on. After they did stop the train, look at it, they said, okay, mush on. We're having some indication that maybe that's not what the crew wanted to do. And they went 4 miles down the track and derailed and spilled thousands of gallons of hot molten paraffin wax onto the city of Sandusky after data was given to them that maybe should have indicated that they needed to take that engine out of commission and out of the abundance of caution and safety. That's the move that should have taken place based on the experts and the union officials that we've spoken to.
So, Greg Hines, you're with the union. I want to talk more about the workers, the rail strike that just was threatened and by the administration or President Biden signing off on a law that says that they couldn't strike, what their issues were then, and if you see any relation to what's happening right now. And specifically when it comes to East Palestine, where you have these three workers who are on the train, what you think needs to happen? The Republicans are having a heyday right now. They're saying, of course, this happened under Biden. Buttigieg, Biden didn't go there. But Trump went. It was Trump who signed off on a deregulation of the trains, caving to the lobbyists. Could Biden in one fell swoop just reverse what Trump did and go back to the Obama-Biden administration rules that were supposed to go into effect, sadly, from 2014 this year in 2023?
Well, all of the waivers that were put forward during the Trump administration should be looked at, the ones that were granted, many of them within minutes of being asked for. And the two-person crew rule, which was the minimum staffing rule, was done during the Obama administration, and it was ready to be released at the end of his term. The Trump administration came in. He appointed a retired railroad CEO to head up the FRA, who decided that we don't need any regulations on crew staffing, and just basically got rid of the entire rulemaking. And not only that, but he said by FRA taking no action on crew staffing, we're going to preempt all the states who have passed two-person crew laws, meaning that we're not going to do anything about it, and we're not going to allow any of the states to do anything about it. The current administration has revisited the crew staffing rule. It's already had its public comment period. It's already had a hearing, and there were over 13,000 comments submitted. They've taken all that information in. and they're going to be releasing a crew staffing rule. But I agree with you that all the regulations waivers that have been granted through the Trump administration should all be reevaluated.
And what about the threatened strike, especially around issues of like sick days that railroad workers, and this is in the time of the pandemic, can't take off sick days?
Well, it's still that way. As far as the strike goes, it was never about money. It was about quality of life and safety because of this business model that the railroads are running and operating under, which they just want to cut precision scheduled railroading. They don't want to allow people to take time off. They want to work you to the end over and over again. They find loopholes in the hours of service so that people never get time off. And our members were just, we can't live like this. We can't live like this. We're gone from our families all the time. If we have a problem in our home, we can't take off without the threat of being fired. I mean, it's really a strong arm system. And the strike was never about money. It was about safety and quality of life.
Finally, 30 seconds back to Emily Wright on the ground in Columbiana County where East Palestine is. What you're demanding right now?
We're demanding first that the Norfolk Southern Corporation, basically pay, and not just pay for this, but change the practices in every way. Like Greg was just discussing, it's absolutely, ridiculous. The staffing, there's no need. It's a multi-billion-dollar corporation.
Posted no record profits this year.
Record profits. And two, we're demanding policy change. We don't care the letter behind your name. We're demanding policy change now. And we're also demanding congressional move on this so we have lasting changes.
Emily Wright, I want to thank you for being with us. Development Director for River Valley Organizing in Columbiana County, Ohio. Greg Hines, National Legislative Director at SMART, the International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation Workers. And Topher Sanders will link to your pieces at ProPublica as you continue to cover railroad safety. Coming up, we go from East Palestine to Palestine, to the occupied West Bank, where Palestinians held a general strike Thursday after Israeli forces killed 11 Palestinians and injured 500. Stay with us. By the Palestinian band, the Trio Gibran. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go now to the occupied West Bank, where Palestinians held a general strike Thursday after Israeli forces killed 11 Palestinians, injured 500 in a rare daytime military raid in the city of Nablus Wednesday.
It is a day of mourning period and a strike. How would we be able to work or eat or drink, and our brothers in Nablus are being killed? We should stand in solidarity with them, with the people of Nablus, and there should be a general strike. And thank God the strike is in all the West Bank and Gaza.
So far this year, Israel's killed at least 65 Palestinians, including 13 children. Early this morning, a 22-year-old Palestinian man named Mohammed Jawabra died a day after being shot in the head during an Israeli raid on the Arub refugee camp north of Hebron. On Thursday, Palestinians held funerals for the victims of Israel's raid in Nablus. One victim was a 72-year-old Palestinian man named Adnan Barra. His son, Ashraf, said that his father was on his way to the market when he was killed.
In the morning, my father went out from the shop to buy some stuff. Then the Israeli army raided the neighborhood. He called me and asked me if there are soldiers in the neighborhood, so I told him yes. They are surrounding the neighborhood from all sides. Suddenly, someone called me and said, "Your father is injured." I was at my shop besieged. I could leave the shop after the army left the city.
We're joined now by the Israeli journalist Amira Haas, the Haaretz correspondent for the occupied Palestinian territory. She's based in Ramallah. Her latest piece is headlined, Israel's Raid on Nablus Proves Willingness of More Young Palestinians to Die in an Unwinnable Battle. Amira Haas is the only Israeli Jewish journalist to have spent 30 years living in and reporting from Gaza and the West Bank. We're also joined by the Palestinian activist Issa Amro. He's in Hebron. He's the founder of the Hebron-based direct action group Youth Against Settlements, now leads the American charity Friends of Hebron. Let's begin with you, Issa. You're in Hebron. We just reported on a killing of an Israeli, of a Palestinian man there. Can you talk about what's happening and what happened in this rare daytime raid in Nablus that where so many Palestinians were killed and hundreds injured?
Yes, 2 days ago, the military forces raided Nablus during the daytime. And they shot many Palestinians. They used live ammunition to kill, to shoot, to confirm the killing of many Palestinians. The Palestinians all over West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem were very sad. And they announced a strike yesterday. And yesterday, clashes started in Al Arub refugee camp in Hebron. The Israeli soldiers shot a Palestinian on the head, and many other were injured. And unfortunately, he passed away this morning, and today it was his funeral. There is a huge anger among the Palestinians from what is happening these days from the Israeli racist and fascist government, who are inciting to kill more and more Palestinians. We see that the Ibrahim Mosque massacre, which happened 29 years ago, when Baruch Goldstein went into the mosque and killed 29 Palestinians, and the supporters of that massacre, the supporter of Baruch Goldstein, they are the ones who are in power. They are in the government. They are the ones who are now leading the Israeli occupation forces all over West Bank and East Jerusalem.
Amira Haas, you wrote in detail about what is happening in Nablus. And, you know, you've taught in New York, for example, at NYU as well. And if you can explain to an audience outside, around the world, what are the details of this attack, from the drones that open fire to the unmarked cars? Explain why. Just give us the picture of Nablus.
Yeah. Hi, Amy. I haven't been in Nablus after the raid. I was in Nablus after an earlier raid and in Jenin. So the pattern is there is one pattern very clear, that an Israeli undercover unit enters a Palestinian, mostly Jenin and Nablus, in a car disguised as some Palestinian food company or something like that. They enter. They find positions, shooting positions around a house where they believe that some Palestinian armed activists stay. And usually this is correct. And then they are supposed to ask them to demand them leave. And if they refuse, they keep shooting until the people are being killed in their hiding place or not hiding place. It happened in Jenin. It happened in Jenin. It has been happening a lot over the years. But there is an intensification of this during the last year. You know, when the Palestinian armed activists decide to give themselves in, it might not end up in so many casualties. But the thing is that you see that these youngsters, it's people who are not older than 30 at most, very often younger. They just decide that they don't want to go to prison. They want to convey a message in the name of the entire Palestinian people that they've had enough. And they are ready to die. And I think this is a very clear message of the last of those activists, armed activists over the past year. Out of the 11 people killed in Nablus, 6 were armed people. So I think we should remember this, that they decide to take arms and to fight the invading army. They decide not to give themselves in. And but of course, when the army decides to enter a city so big as Nablus on daytime at 9:30, and then stay there till 12:30 when all the kids go back from school, and to be near the marketplace, it's clear that the army and the police, because it's mostly the police that does the shooting, in these cases, it's clear that they decide to, they don't care about how many people they kill and how many people they injure.
Because so the roads are packed, because this is in the middle of the day and people are going to market.
Sure, it's packed. It's then the drones, I don't know yet. This is something that I still have to check. There were drones, as there were in Jenin and Nablus in former raids, but I'm not sure yet that these drones were shooting. But the fear, even the very knowledge that those drones not only are surveillance drones or drones that launch tear gas canisters, or tear gas, but that they can also shoot. You can imagine how much it adds to the fear. But there is not only fear. If there are enough footage, though they don't allow ambulances and journalists to approach the place, and this has been so for several raids already, but still from the little footage that I saw, maybe there is more, you see that there are hundreds of young men or tens of young men so brave that they go out without arms, only with stones, and throw at the Israeli, at the military vehicles. And I guess that many of them were injured, if not killed. So let me go to
Issa Amro for a minute.
So what's important to know, what's important is to also stress that there is a resistance. So in every such raid, people resist it. It's not just, a quiet scene where all of a sudden the army comes in. It comes into a quiet scene, but then people resist it.
So, Issa Amro, an Israeli soldier was recently jailed for 10 days after he attacked you. As you were being interviewed by the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Lawrence Wright, I want to play a short clip of what happened.
Don't touch me.
Michael.
Hey! Leave him!
Are you serious? Follow with me.
I want an ambulance. I don't know.
What's the matter with you, guy? Are you so bored?
After video of the attack on you went viral, Israel's far-right national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who's been convicted on inciting racism charges, expressed full support for the Israeli soldier who attacked you. Describe the scene and what happened.
What happened that I lead tours in my own city to show Israelis, internationals, Palestinians, the reality of the Israeli occupation, the real face of the Israeli occupation in my own city, the closed streets, the closed markets, the checkpoints, the settlers' presence in the middle of my own city. There are streets where I'm not allowed to walk as a Palestinian, in spite that I was born there and I was raised there and all my childhood was there. So me and Mr. Wright, he was walking on the main street and I was walking on the graveyard, because I'm not allowed to walk on the main street. And, a Belgian photographer was with Mr. Wright. I was speaking to Mr. Wright, showing him the reality, closed shops, closed markets, and how few Palestinian families, they use the back door to get into their homes because the main door is closed. The soldiers didn't like that. Usually they don't want us to show the reality of the Israeli occupation, especially to international. So the soldier approached me and asked me to leave and not talk to them. I really told the soldier, no, I'm allowed, and I don't have time. Okay, Lawrence, we will meet where we are allowed to meet. Then I reached the point where I'm allowed to meet Lawrence and the Belgian photographer. I found the soldier forcing the Belgian photographer to delete her video, which she filmed. So I told them, no, I'm allowed. What are you doing? We are allowed to film this. And according to the military law, the tiny rights we have as Palestinians in the military law, we are allowed to do it.
So the soldier got very angry. How come I tell him that I'm allowed? He, you know, caught me from my shoulder, you know, violently detained me in the street, and you know, threatened me, intimidated me. Then he came, caught me from my throat, threw me to the ground, and kicked me again and hit me again. Other soldier, you know, took him away from me because of the camera. And it's not a rare incident. It's the case of all the Palestinians who are living under the Israeli occupation and apartheid and face the Israeli soldiers' brutality and the settler violence. Then I asked for an ambulance. I didn't get. Soldiers were rejoicing with the settlers for what happened to me. Settlers were spitting on me when I was on the ground. And I was really ill-treated, traumatized, and I was in pain, asking for help, and nobody helped me from the Israeli side.
I hate to keep traumatizing you further, but I wanted to ask you about the Israeli authorities arresting you last year, shortly after you posted a video showing an Israeli soldier throwing an Israeli activist to the ground and then punching them in the face in the city of Hebron in the occupied West Bank. Before you were released, you were beaten at the police station, your home raided. The Israeli activist, Miko Peled, tweeted, Issa's life is in danger, and there must be guarantees to his personal safety. Miko Peled is the son of the legendary Israeli general Mati Peled. Talk about that.
Yes, now Miko Peled is receiving online death threats too for doing this kind of things. Yes, last November, the same case as last week, what happened with me, Israeli soldier punished an Israeli visitor who tried to apologize for Palestinian families who were attacked by fanatic extreme Israeli settlers. And I found another soldier, Amy, saying that Itamar Ben-Gvir will make an order here and he will get rid of you. Filming that made me a target. And the Israeli media described me as a provocateur. As last week, they didn't blame the soldier for what he did to me. They blamed me for filming. They blamed me from reporting. This is the case of many other human rights defenders. Israel tries to hide the truth. They don't want us to report. They don't want us to document the human rights violation. With my case, the soldier attacked me. The Israeli army spokesperson lied about what happened with me. The Israeli official, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who is the national security minister, backed up the soldier and gave a green light to other soldiers to shoot and kill and attack Palestinians and attack me. The Israeli media described me as a provocateur, and the Israeli public, they didn't defend me and they didn't denounce the Israeli soldiers' behavior in 1 week ago and in last November. So the soldiers, they have a real an environment and atmosphere of incitement and escalation, and you know, they want to be really you know, following Itamar Ben-Gvir and other populists to show Palestinians more brutality and, you know, to revenge from Palestinian human rights defender who document the human rights violation. And really, I have fear of my life from what I see from the Israeli soldiers and the backup from the army and the backup from the government and even the backup of from the Israeli media, which is giving the soldiers excuses for what they are doing. You know, what happened with me, so it was so obvious on videos, but the Israeli media lied about it and the Israeli army lied about it.
Amira Haas, we're going to end with you. You have the attack on Nablus. You hear what Issa's describing. You've got Israel's military bombing parts of the Gaza Strip after Palestinian militants fired rockets at southern Israel this week, with the Nablus raid being a huge provocation. Where is this going? We have 30 seconds.
Look, I mean, everything that has been described here has happened before. But and to Issa as well, also under former governments. The problem that now, and Israel has always was experimenting after the Nakba with all sorts of expulsion. What I'm afraid now is that we have the strongest people in this present Israeli government are politicians of the right wing who have openly advocated for mass expulsion of Palestinians. It's Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. They are the strongest. And if you go to Hebron, where Issa lives,
Amira,
then it is the...
We're going to have to leave it there, but I thank you both for being with us. Amira Haas, Haaretz correspondent, and Issa Amra.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.